I'm going to guess it might be a Lagrange point. Which is it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
No, 600 kilometer high orbit, you know, circular. So, it's not going to be a lot of Lagrange point. And, it's going to be launched from, really an equatorial island, Kwajalein Island. I remember W2DXJ used to talk about that. He was stationed there during World War II. And that's the island that they have this company, Orbital Science Corporation. It's actually a private corporation that will launch this for NASA and Jet Propulsion Laboratory. And it'll get up there. It's got nice big solar panel, 600 watts on the solar panel. That's pretty much it. I did have one question for you, Dick, because, they talk about the TARD x-rays, and this will be looking in the 6 to 79, I think it's kilo electron volts. Usually you hear angstroms or, different frequencies or where they put it. It's almost like they're talking about what goes on in these atom smashes when they talk about electron volts. But that's how it's measured, 6 to 79 kilo electron volts. I was going to research it. I didn't have time why they call it that. Back to you.
Yeah, in the old days, you measured frequency with lecture wires, and you looked for that standing wave. You set up an intentional standing wave, and you looked at the distance between two valleys or two peaks, and that you figured out was the half wavelength. So we called it the 80-meter band and the 20-meter band because that was the distance between the waves on the lecture wires, and that was the way to measure wavelength because you couldn't count cycles in those days. You didn't have anything that went fast enough. You didn't measure frequency. Nowadays, we live in frequency instead of wavelength. Okay, the optical people tend to live in wavelengths. The middle of the optical band is 550 nanometers. Near infrared is 1 micron, and far infrared is 10 microns, and so on. We're back to measuring wavelengths when it comes to optical and near infrared and near ultraviolet. When you start getting up to the soft x-rays and the hard x-rays, the wavelengths start becoming so small, the frequency starts becoming so high. The frequencies are numbers like 10 to the 17, 10 to the 18. You haven't got a frequency counter that can count that fast, so you're not going to measure frequency when it comes to an x-ray. The wavelengths are so darn small, you're not going to measure the wavelength. So instead, they measure the amount of energy. E equals h nu, the Planck equation. There's a direct relationship between the amount of energy, the amount of energy of a wave and the frequency of the wave. One particle running at that frequency, running at that frequency, has a given amount of energy related by the Planck equation. So when they get up to these x-rays, I am guessing now, maybe somebody's going to correct me, that you no longer measure frequency, you no longer measure wavelength, now you measure energy. You could have measured the energy at the optical frequencies. The optical frequencies are measured in electron volts if you want to, but it's not a system of units we often use. So this 6 to 79 kilo electron volts is really measuring, call it the wavelength, call it the frequency, call it the frequency region, call it the band, if you know what I mean. How much energy is in that wave is really how hard is that x-ray, how high is the frequency, or how short is the wavelength. That's what I think is going on. Does that seem to make some sense, Paul? WS2N. By the way, at 600 kilometers high, which is essentially beyond the range that the space shuttle can go to, that tells me that this particular spacecraft is never going to be repaired. It's never going to get an update from the shuttle at 600 kilometers. The Hubble Space Telescope is only at half that distance. So they're not going to repair this one. They're going to send it out there once. Because it's out there so far, it's going to take a zillion years to come back, so they don't have to worry about deorbiting it, is my belief. But I think this is a one-shot deal. You better get it right, because you're not going to go back and repair it. That's my guess on this one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
The highest the shuttle ever went to, I think, was 600, but it was slightly elliptical. This thing going into a, you know, regular circular orbit, so yeah, that will be out. And I think they do that for a reason. They try to keep away from the too high or too low. You know, they want to keep away from the Van Allen belts. That throws everything off. But it's never going to be visited. It's only going to be a 2-year mission, really. And I think it'll probably quit. Unless, you know, a lot of times they have an extended mission. It's not one of these things with our helium on board, hydrogen. You know, that's always a big problem with that type of telescope. James Webb is going to be like that, but it's not really going to be affected the way the thing is designed. It won't have that problem. So that's going to be a 10-year mission. It's probably, of course, extended after that. Very good, Dick. Good explanation on the kilovolts, kilo-electron volts. Very well done. Didn't know what they were doing there. Back to you.
Yeah, we were using Planck's equation in the really backwards manner when a buddy of mine, Tom Williams, and I were studying if we use an extremely narrowband radio receiver and looked for a very long period of time for a very weak signal that had bounced off the moon, could you take a 1-watt transmitter into a dipole antenna, transmit enough signal to the moon that when it came back, you'd be able to receive that signal? What's the weakest signal you can possibly listen to? We started getting down to what's the amount of energy in one single wave, so to speak, at 10 gigahertz. And I think we came to the conclusion it was like minus 210 dBm. No signal generator gets within a mile of that one, if you know what I mean. Yeah, let me go back to this inverse square law, and I'm going to show you something very interesting. I'll give you a little bit of an explanation for why the optical people have got so darn many terms. I just showed you that when you took a room that had a certain diameter so that it had 100 square meters of total area, and you had a 100-watt light bulb in the middle of the room, therefore each square meter got 1 watt, and you doubled the diameter of the room, and now the room's got double the diameter, therefore it's got 4 times the amount of area, because area of a sphere is 4 pi r squared. We've just squared the r that just got doubled, therefore it got 4 times bigger, the total area. So now you've got 400 square meters of the room, 100 watts from the bulb, therefore each square meter gets 1/4 of a watt. 1/4 of a watt shows that you've got the inverse square law. I doubled the distance, I got 1/4 the power. That's inverse square law when you've got a point source. Now, if I made the room a cylindrical room, and if the source of light is an extremely long fluorescent tube, it's now a line source instead of a point source. And you do the exact same experiment. You figure out how many watts per square meter comes out of the light bulb, out of the fluorescent light, and how many watts do you get onto the cylindrical surface of this room, and you double the diameter of the room. What happens? You'll get 1/2 the area. In other words, if the source of illumination is a very long line source, and you start off close to it, and you move away from it, but you're still close to it compared to its total length. In other words, it looks like a line source that goes to infinity to the left and infinity to the right from your point of view. Now it obeys the inverse linear law. You double the distance from that source of light, and you'll get exactly 1/2 the amount of watts per square meter on your surface. Linear sources do that. Now let's go the next step. Let's make the source of illumination a flat room of luminescent panels. I got a very large wall where the whole wall has equal illumination across every square meter.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
That's the source of light. I've got an evenly distributed light source room. It's called a Lambertian source. So I got a room that's got very large dimensions, left and right, up and down. I'm reasonably close to that wall, and I'm getting a certain number of watts per square meter onto my sensing device as I stand in front of this illuminated wall. And now I double the distance between me and the wall. What happens? Nothing. Whatever number of watts per square meter I measured when I was close to the wall, and I double my distance from the wall, I get the exact same number of watts per square meter. At first that sounds crazy, but look at it from the other point of view. Assume you're looking at the wall with your particular eyeball, and your eyeball has a certain subtendon angle over which it's gathering light. And maybe your total eyeball, the majority of your retina is responding across a 30-degree angle from left to right and a 30-degree up and down. By the way, your eye has a resolution of a 60th of a degree in the fovea, in the macular area, but we won't go there right now. We're not trying to resolve fine details of this wall. We're just looking at this wall. And my eye has got a 30-degree beamwidth in azimuth and a 30-degree beamwidth in elevation, up and down versus left and right. And when I'm close to the wall, I'm looking at a certain number of square meters of the wall with my eye. And I'm not sweeping my eye. My eye is just always looking straight forward. Let me drop. Now when I double the distance from me and the wall, for each little dot, let's assume the wall is made out of a million light-emitting diodes. Each individual light-emitting diode, I have doubled the distance between me and that particular light-emitting diode. For if I'm only looking at one light-emitting diode at a time, and I back away from the wall by doubling the distance, I obey the inverse square law compared to that particular light-emitting diode. But now when I'm looking at all of these light-emitting diodes all at once across this wall, my eye is 30 degrees left and right and 30 degrees up and down. When I double the distance between me and the wall, I see twice as many light-emitting diodes left to right. I see twice as many light-emitting diodes up and down. I see four times as many light-emitting diodes when I double the distance from me and the wall with my 30-degree eyeball, 30-degree viewing eyeball. So I'm looking at four times as many light-emitting diodes, and each one is giving me one quarter of the amount of power. You can see why it's a wash. If you've got a completely uniform illuminated wall and you double the distance, the brilliance, the amount of light you get in watts per square meter does not change. Now when you understand those three principles, point source, line source, and uniform flat wall source, so to speak, it gives you a little bit more of an understanding of where some of these crazy words in the optical world come from. When you're looking at stars with a telescope, for the most part, you're looking at a point source. And you can figure out exactly how much light you're getting from that particular star. Eventually, you figure out the range of that particular star by a whole bunch of techniques. And now you can figure out what is the absolute power coming out of the star. Our particular star called Sun puts out a power of 10 to the 27 watts, day and night. Summer, winter, fall, and spring.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And it's done that for the last 5 billion years, and we've got another 5 billion years to go before it runs down. And when you look at the total amount of power coming out of the sun for the 10 billion years of its life, it's 10 to the 43 joules of energy, watts times seconds. Joules of energy, 10 to the 43. But one watt, 10 to the 27 watts coming out of the sun really means 10 to the 27 joules per second are coming out of the sun. And but E equals MC squared, you can easily calculate exactly how fast the mass of the sun is being consumed. And you go through that mathematics and you'll find out that it's going to use up something like 25% of its mass in 10 billion years, in which case it flips over to another mode of operation. So you can easily figure out the energy relationship of the sun with relatively simple mathematics, once you understand a couple of simple principles. So now these crazy terms of the optical people, stars are a point source, yeah. The sun is not a point source. For most of the instruments you and I are likely to use, Wes, that sun is half a degree wide, left and right, and up and down. It is a distributed source. So we have to look at it it's halfway between Lambertian and point source, if you know what I mean. So watts per square meter, yeah, you can do that depending on the beam width of your particular telescope. When you set up a moon-bounce antenna and you're aiming it at the moon or aiming at the sun because it's a radio telescope, as you double the gain of the dish, it gets to a smaller and smaller beam width by a very predictable manner. Let me think now. 71 degrees divided by number of wavelengths of your aperture tells you the beam width. Well, you go through the mathematics and you'll find out that when your moon bounce antenna approaches 51 dB of gain, it now has something like half a degree of beam width. The whole darn moon is only half a degree wide. So as you make the antenna higher and higher in gain, above 51 dB, and some hams can do that, do you continue to get a stronger and stronger signal from moon bounce? And the answer is no. You're not lighting up the whole moon anymore. You're only lighting up one little dot on the moon. And you're receiving signal from only one little dot on the moon. And so, ordinarily, every time you double the gain of your antenna, you double the amount of power that hits the moon, you double the amount of power you get as a reflection, so you get twice the... every time I go up 3 dB in gain on my moon bounce antenna, I get 6 dB more echo if it's a medium gain antenna. I get 6 dB more gain every time I... 6 dB more signal every time I increase the gain of the antenna by 3 dB. But when the antenna gets down to a 51... dB of gain, half a degree of beam width and beyond, you don't get that anymore. You start running into another set of rules, if you know what I mean. And so some of these crazy words in the optical world are trying to explain some of this point source, line source, Lambertian source problem. And I don't understand all of their words yet. However, I do know that the Ayers disc of a diffraction-limited telescope, let me show you this one, it's a crazy one that I've written an article on this a couple of times, and people give me flack at first and slowly say, yeah, maybe he's right. Let me drop. If I'm using a real good optical telescope that's very well tuned, it's so-called diffraction limited. In other words, there's no error in the parabolic mirror. There's no error in the eyepiece. Everything is working just the way it's supposed to. You now look at a real point source bright star, and you take a photograph, and you blow up the photograph. What do you see? You see a bright circle in the center. You see a slightly dimmer ring around that, and a more dimmer ring and a larger diameter around it. You see a whole series of rings around this bright center. And at first you'll say, gee, the telescope must not be properly focused. That's the best focus you can get, the so-called Ayer disk. And you go to the right optical book, as I did one day, and they tell you exactly how much energy is in that center dot, how much energy is in that first ring, and how bright is it, and how much energy is in that second ring, and you suddenly see a relationship. You see a relationship in that the first dot in the middle is the main lobe of the antenna. Even though you call it a telescope, it is an antenna. That first ring around it is the first side lobe of that antenna. And that first side lobe is 17.5 dB down. The second ring is the second side lobe, and it's 22.5 dB down. And now all of a sudden you start saying, gee, I've seen those numbers before. An extremely well-tuned Yagi antenna, the first side lobe, when you've got maximum gain, is 17.5 dB down. The second side lobe is 22 dB down. So it's something like 30 dB down. In other words, our Yagi antennas, when they're properly tuned, give you a aperture distribution, a circular area of the radio capture area of that antenna, as if it was a parabolic mirror on a telescope. It is almost diffraction limited. You can tune your Yagi for a higher side lobe than 17 dB, and you lose gain. You can tune it for a lower side lobe than 17.5 dB, and you lose gain again. When it is diffraction limited, when you've got a thoroughly uniform distribution across a circle, the laws of physics, the diffraction effects, the Fourier transform, call it what you like, aperture distribution, the window functions are the words they use for it. The window functions of round apertures with uniform distribution is that the first side lobe was 17.5 dB down, second side lobe will be 20 dB down. When you tune your Yagi antenna for some other amplitude of side lobes, and this became real important because there's a fairly famous guy who is now a silent key, who spent the last 20 years of his life using computer modeling programs for Yagi antennas, looking for the magic formula for Yagi antenna tuning where all the side lobes would disappear. Good common sense would lead you to believe that the energy in the side lobes is wasted energy. And if you could take the energy of the side lobes and put it back into the bore site, into the main lobe, you'd have a higher gain antenna. Good common sense. Not true. If the Yagi had an infinite area, maybe you could almost make it true. But for the Yagis you and I can really build on planet Earth, finite in size, they're going to have a round aperture. Your parabolic dish, in most cases, is going to have a round aperture. And the laws of physics of a uniform distribution are that when you've got the power equally smeared across the dish, which is the highest efficiency you're ever going to get, 100% aperture efficiency, 100% aperture efficiency antenna is a one-to-one relationship with a diffraction-limited telescope. The side lobes will be that amplitude because you've got that uniform round distribution and a sharp edge off the side. The energy that must abruptly fall to zero at the sides of the parabolic dish or at the sides of your parabolic reflector on your Newtonian telescope, because of that fast, sharp fall-off at the edge, it is a strong discontinuity. You could say Mother Nature doesn't like discontinuities. Whenever she sees one, she makes side lobes in the time domain, in the amplitude domain, in the frequency domain, in the angular domain, the spatial domain. She's going to make side lobes when there's a sharp discontinuity. You could gradually taper the energy as you go toward the edge of the dish if you want to, and the side lobes will get weaker, but because you're not using that great big area out at the perimeter with 100% efficiency, the gain...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So you can taper the energy out near the perimeter if you want to, and you'll lower the side lobes. But now, because you're using all of that great area out at the perimeter, you're not using it to full efficiency, you get lower gain. So the thing that's opposite of common sense is that once you've got an antenna tuned for those magic numbers of side lobes, and everything else is working correctly, that's the best performance, the highest gain you're ever going to get out of that main lobe. And when you tune the side lobes to a lower number, the gain goes down. Of course that doesn't make common sense. I'm taking the energy of the side lobes, I'm putting it in the main lobe. Yeah, but the main lobe gets more broad. When you don't have the edge power out at the edge of the perimeter, the beam width of the antenna increases and the gain goes down. I know this is off to one side, but it explains some of these crazy terms the optical people use, if you know what I mean, Wes. N2XJM, K2RIW.
Yeah, I know what you say. The unit of quantity is a watt per square meter, and it doesn't have really a special frame, but we could say that a power in watts divided by a square meter equals power in watts divided by square meters, if we're talking about the environment that you mentioned before. We also could start the analysis of this quantity by recording the definition of power, let's say the rate of which energy is transformed and energy density, which would be the energy per volume. I would say, since we start a graphical picturing of tri-dimensional space, I would reward what you say. So let's say imagine a beam of light or radio waves or any other kind of electromagnetic wave landing on a surface. That's what you said about the wall. The energy then falls on the surface even in a given amount of time, fills a column that travels through the space at speed of light. The value of this column is the area at its base times its length. So the area can be an arbitrary size since we're dealing with the density here. And the length of this column is determined by the time. It takes a column, for the column to land on the surface while traveling at the speed of light. So that would be something that I wanted to picture. Now, I would like to, because we have a little bit of time left, I would like to ask Glenn and you to come back to this video that I have sent you yesterday, last time, and there was a tree part of it. There was absolutely amazing discussion. Again, I hope Limark will not really create a bargain for me disconnecting a repeater. You cannot send the students to the home if they want to stay after the TechNet and discuss the professor's thoughts. And to
Okay, When it comes to the last few weeks of 12 o'clock cutoff, that was dictated by K2RIW. The Limock people followed my request that it be cut off at 12 o'clock because I'm going through a relatively difficult period where I've got to be to work in the morning at earlier than my normal hours, if you know what I mean. I'm a retired person, but I'm working every day. And because of a rush project I'm on, I have to be there earlier. And that's one of two projects that I'm running at once. And there's another project that I'm running that requires my time. So 4 hours of the TechNet is a reasonable, after 29 and a half years, dedication on my part. So I'm cutting it off after 4 hours for the time being. This may not be permanent, but for the next few weeks at least, it is me doing that. You guys can go on until the sun rises if you want to. You have my permission. If Limock will let you do it. I think they might.
Dick, I'm sorry interrupting you.
Yeah, but Echo Alpha? But I'm the guy that's asking. I'm asking for K2RIW to be relieved at midnight.
Dick, I'm sorry. We have two issues. The TechNet ends up, and the repeater stops at 12 midnight. I want to just say a few words about it. At my base, perception and knowledge, they did not stop the repeater at 12 midnight. They requested the end of the TechNet, which is completely understandable. So it looks like, based on my perception, I may be wrong, it is an intentional action to stop the crowd participating in this event. You know, they have extended hours for 6 days a week. Somebody say, well, we have to have a comfort and we cannot monitor. They can monitor 6 days a week, but they cut off the repeater at 12 o'clock. You know, for me, it should be Dick till 12 o'clock with TechNet and free discussion after 12 based on Dick's willingness to participate if he only wants to. So Dick is an item. And this is not the best way to celebrate 30 years of his voluntary dedication to the TechNet and to education. Yes.
Oh, hold on, Wes. The 12 o'clock cutoff of the machine is not their doing. It was my request. I requested that for two reasons. One, I had some feeling for the people who have to do the monitoring late on Sunday night, but the main reason is that I knew that enthusiastic people, as we approach 12 o'clock, if it was purely Dick Nadler requesting it, K2RIW requesting it, would say, hey, can't you answer one more question? And it happened to me again last week. Glenn and I got hot and heavy on something that I wanted to understand, and I stayed way beyond 12 o'clock. The 12 o'clock cutoff of the machine is my request because my understanding of human nature is that if it was purely me making the request, I suspected that some of the people in the audience wouldn't accept that. So I requested that they turn it off at 12 o'clock. It wasn't their doing. It is my doing. I caused it.
I understand that. I have no problem. Thank you for explaining me what is happening here. I believe that you should not send the students home if they want to stay on the repeater. And they talked about a professor thoughts and the professor education that was given to them. You know, that should happen. So I would be greatly appreciated if you can rethink your decision and to make that happen. I'm not on the repeater for the whole week. At least I understand that I should not talk technical issues during a week time. So I'm not doing that. I'm not there. I completely obey the rules of the Limock. But this is something that really makes me upset. Especially the number of letters that I have got, and I simply don't understand where they're coming from and what is the contents based on my limited skills of understanding English and express myself properly. So, Dick, if that is not a big deal for you, just rethink that. You don't have to be there. Just let the students be there if they want to. And to experience.
Yeah, the displeasure you feel and the anger maybe you feel is really toward me. I caused it. John, you want to make a comment?
Yes, Dick. You know, the analogy's notwithstanding. What he's asking is, he doesn't want the repeater turned off. You go home, you do what you're going to do after 12, and he wants to be able to stay on the repeater. That's basically what he's answering, but he's taking 25 minutes to do it.
Okay, what's the next subject you would like to discuss in the remaining 18 minutes, Wes, go ahead.
And to Z Echo Alpha.
Z Echo Alpha, we'll start off with your name, sir.
Dick, name's Glenn, N2ZEA. I spoke to you guys last week about a contact enhancer, and you told me to come back and let you know what happened.
Yeah. This is a magic substance you were going to find that would take scratchy contacts and make them work a lot better. How expensive? Where did you buy it? How well does it work? You got it, Glenn.
Thank you. I found some miracle stuff from Allied Electronics. It's called Carbon Conductive Grease. It was $12, and it works incredible.
Carbon Conductive Grease is sold in what container? How many dollars?
It was $12. It's in a toothpaste kind of tube. They also had Silver Conductive Grease. That was $50, so we went for the cheap stuff. I put it on the RCA connectors, and all my problems went away. I highly recommend it.
That's good news. So, carbon conductive grease, and I think you said sold by Allied Electronics. How did you find out about that one, Glenn?
You guys gave me two words last weekend, which was Allied Electronics and grease, and that's how I found it.
Yeah, I was predicting that you were going to find a product of the Miller Stephens company that did it, and maybe they've got one. But I have heard about the silver conductive grease. I didn't know that there was a carbon conductive grease. And you have the silver conductive grease. My guess is that I think you said it's $50 for a toothpaste tube. And so you've got to be pretty serious to need that. And the carbon conductive grease at $12 a tube did it. Well done. Thank you. Wes, go ahead with your next subject.
Last week, you and Glenn got to the heavy discussion. And that heavy discussion was absolutely excellent. So I would like you and Glenn to continue. I have sent you the additional videos, parts for that discussion. We have a high voltage coil and we have a low current coil. A high current coil. At the same time, low voltage coil. That is extremely important to me. Back to you and Glenn, if you are still there.
Yeah, I played back the recording of last week while I was doing some work at a factory. I was doing some tune-up of a whole bunch of assemblies, and I was able to listen in the background at the same time. I listened to that recording, and I suddenly realized what was happening is that Glenn kept saying over and over again that as he separates the secondary from the primary of this transformer-like structure, the current goes down. The current goes down, the voltage goes down, but the current stays the same. He kept saying the current stays the same, but the voltage goes down. And I was using the example of a low impedance coil with a 10 ohm resistor, and I said, if the voltage is going down, but the current stays the same, you're violating Ohm's law. He kept saying it over and over again. The current stays the same. The missing ingredient was the current ratio stays the same. The current ratio between primary current and secondary current, the ratio stays the same. The word ratio got dropped, and therefore I had a lot with it. Now that I understand what Glenn was saying, it was the whatever primary current flows and it decreases as you separate the two, the secondary voltage goes down and the current goes down, and it's the ratio of currents that stay the same even though you do the separation. And there's another way of looking at that. If Glenn I'm going to put my point forth. If Glenn is there, he can say I agree or disagree, and here's my point.
A mother in the background, Dick.
Yeah, I was missing that magic word ratio. It was very clear in your head, but the word wasn't coming out of your mouth, and I didn't get it, the ratio being the same. Here's one way to
think. Dick, we need a video blackboard to this TechNet KZ2QIQ.
Yeah, but if we try hard enough and use the right words, we can verbally come close to drawing a mental picture. Here's what I think happens, Glenn. If you've got a reasonable design of a transformer with real resistance in the primary and secondary winding, if it's a reasonable design of the transformer and you have no load on it, the magnetization current should be a fairly small fraction of the maximum current the transformer is good for. If your transformer is good for 10 amperes of primary current, and it can do that steady state, and if your magnetization current is, let me pick a number, 50 milliamperes, then it's a very small number compared to the 10 amperes, and we can almost ignore that. When I turn on the voltage on the primary, the 60 cycle, 110 volts, or 240 volts, for instance, that generates a certain magnitude of magnetic field. That magnetic field must be there in order for your primary inductance to be high enough so that your magnetizing current is a low enough number. Once that magnetic field is generated by the primary and the secondary is anywhere nearby, the secondary will intercept some percentage of that magnetic field. The current that flows in the secondary winding, by definition, is in a direction that tries to create a magnetic field that is bucking the magnetic field made by the primary. It's an opposing magnetic field created by the secondary. The secondary, as it draws current through its load, makes an opposing magnetic field. The opposing magnetic field lowers the magnetic field to some degree the primary is generating. The primary winding senses that. The back EMF decreases, and the current in the primary goes up to compensate. The primary tries to go back to the same amount of magnetic field so that it has the same amount of back EMF so that it goes, tries to go back to its magnetization current, if you know what I mean. So it is the bucking action. Because that bucking action is changing the primary current in a predictable... Because it's changing that primary current in a predictable manner, I now see how the ratio stays the same, even with resistance in the winding. If I've got a one-to-one winding and I've done something by moving the secondary further away so it's less magnetically coupled, and the current in the secondary, the voltage in the secondary winding went down to half voltage, which by definition with a fixed load resistor, if it's a pure resistor, is half current. But the current in the primary will also go down by half because it didn't sense as much bucking action because of the lack of the coupling. So it is this coupling action that is the bucking EMF, the bucking magnetic field of the secondary winding, is the mechanism by which the primary winding increases or decreases when you move it closer or further away. And it's the method by which, if you ignore the magnetization current, the ratio of primary current and secondary current will always be the same. Ratio will be the same. I was missing that magic word. Now I agree as you separate them. Does that seem like I'm finally catching on to this one, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Absolutely, Dick, right on. And it's just an interesting point that a lot of people, when they measure transformers, they try to, you know, for turns ratio, one of the things that they always try to do is measure inductance, and inductance will give you some very difficult way to get accurate measurements of turns ratio in a transformer, or applied voltage. Try to use an oscilloscope, look at the applied voltage on one winding and the other. It'll get you close. But you can still see a turn off in the transformer. But if you really want an accurate turns ratio in a transformer, is to have a known primary current and measure the currents in the secondary, and then look at the current ratio from primary to secondary, and usually that will give you the most accurate measurement of turns ratio in a transformer without opening it up and counting any winding stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
I have a question for both of you guys. What was the primary reason for that NASA contractor to present that work for NASA, and NASA being interested with it? Just that a few words.
Yeah, back up a step here, though. You said that tells you turns ratio. Doesn't it tell you the inverse of the turns ratio? If I had if the secondary was half the number of turns of the primary, wouldn't the ratio of the currents be 2-to-1? Over to you, Glenn.
Yes, they are in the standard form.
So, with less turns in the secondary, I would have more current in the secondary. And so, if the current in the secondary is a bigger number than the primary, then I know the secondary has less turns, not more turns. You said it's a direct relationship. I think it's an inverse relationship. Do I have that right?
Yes, you do. And from current to turns ratio is an inverse proportion.
Now, Wes's subject is that that those people who were making a presentation for NASA, and I don't think they were NASA people, and you were starting to say now that as you change the coupling between a high impedance coil and a second and a low impedance coil, you were implying that you get an increase in RPM. And that's how we got into this transformer, and now I think you want to go back to that one. Go ahead, Glenn.
What they were talking about was mutually coupled transformers and a generator with a magnet. And the point that I was getting to here is that you have a voltage coupling ratio, and that basically will, even though you have a certain number of turns in a lower turn coil and versus a higher turn coil that are mutually coupled, those two windings, if you were to create a generator around it, what will happen is with that kind of a turns ratio to the loading effect, there's a point at which as you start rotating and creating a rotational force at lower RPMs, there's an effect on coupling because of frequency and rotation that destroy the coupling between the windings. As the velocity increases, the voltage coupling improves associated to frequency. Transformers have a cutoff in frequency. As you increase frequency, you can improve voltage coupling. So when you're at lower RPMs, in a typical standard motor, you'll find that there's a lot of torque required to spin up the motor. But if you have one that is frequency dependent in coupling between two windings, you can have a motor even though it has a load on the output, because the frequency as you start rotating the motor is very, very slow, you don't feel a lot of backward force until you start increasing the velocity until the point where the frequency of those magnets passing by the coils improves the coupling, and then you have good load transfer. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Let's see if I can relate that now to our 1-to-1 transformer that you and I talked about a lot last week and its current ratios. If I separate the secondary winding magnetic structure from the primary winding and its magnetic structure, so I've decreased the magnetic coupling, and now the voltage out of the secondary has decreased, the current out of the secondary has gone down, the primary current has gone down by the same ratio, I think you're telling me that with certain kinds of iron and certain kinds of coupling, if I change the frequency I'm putting into the primary, the coupling ratio might change. Is that what you're saying, Glenn? Go ahead.
Absolutely. What you'll notice is that transformers are frequency dependent, that there's a point at which you have, at certain operational frequencies in the design of transformer, you'll have very, very good voltage coupling from primary to secondary. If the frequency usually is too low, it's very apparent to see how fast the voltage coupling falls off. That if you have a very, very low frequency and your magnetization current is too high, other things are happening, and basically the transformer does not couple very, very well. In the case of a magnetically coupled inductive motor attached to said transformer, when the load coupling is bad on the transformer, there's very, very little load on the motor as you initially start to spin it up. But as you start getting closer, where the load is being coupled to within the bandwidth of the transformer, and then the power starts transferring, and you start feeling the backward EMF force or the loading effect on the rotor aperture. Can you follow that one, Dick?
I think I do. And let me run this silly example of low frequency, high frequency, medium frequency of a transformer. I've got a normal transformer. Normal construction techniques. I'm separating the secondary winding magnetically from the primary winding. I've got a cut core, and I'm putting an airspace between the two. If I go low enough in frequency where the primary core starts almost saturating, I start getting a significant increase in magnetization current, so now I start seeing quite a bit of primary current that doesn't necessarily represent secondary performance, if you know what I mean. If I go too low in frequency, and as the core starts saturating and the current in that primary winding starts going very nonlinear, I'm sure I can get some pretty crazy effects. Now I'm smart enough to raise the frequency to where the magnetization current is not significant. The transformer is working like a charm. I get a lot more coupling. As I start going higher and higher in frequency, I eventually get to the point where the eddy currents in my laminations of my magnetic structure starts taking over, and the current at the primary starts climbing again, and I start getting another kind of inefficiency due to eddy currents. So I'm led to believe that there's probably a magic frequency region where for a given magnetic separation, I get maximum performance out of the transformer. Is that approximately true? KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Absolutely. There's going to be a bandwidth of frequency that you can operate within that's going to give you the best power transformer with the minimum amount of losses between it. And what's also interesting is that if you're basically interested in cutting off the low frequency, you could put a capacitor in series with that transformer, a coupling capacitor, so that when you're at low frequencies, this way you don't even have the magnetization currents in the winding because the capacitor is actually cutting it off to an open circuit. So then as you start increasing the frequency of the motor, as the frequency increases, the coupling factor improves, and then the coupling, both of the coupling capacitor and the performance of the coupling in the transformer, both come into play at about the same time, so that motor has very, very low torque requirements at low RPMs. But as the frequency of the motor is increasing with increased RPM, the loading now is being coupled from the motor through the transformer, and then all of a sudden you have very, very good load connection. Can you see that? The K2RZ and KC2QIQ.
Yeah, I'm starting to catch on this one. By the way, when you put a capacitor in series with a primary winding, where there's a significant amount of inductance in that winding, depending on the amount of loading of that secondary, you've got to be a little bit careful, because if you hit resonance between that inductor and capacitor, you can get some pretty peculiar effects. The people who use swinging chokes and whatever in certain kinds of power supplies, switching power supplies, where the pulse width modulation is really a frequency modulation of a constant pulse width, you can sometimes run into some weird resonance effects. You have to be careful with that one, in my opinion. Oh, over to you, Glenn.
But in this particular application, if you design everything just right, you can actually have an effect where that resonance, it doesn't. All it will really do is conduct the energy back into the motor again. So there you have a loading effect on this type of motor design, where as you start spinning up the motor, you'll have a very, very good throughput power to your load. And then if you create a unloading effect, what will actually happen is you'll start accelerating the motor backwards in the other direction. KC2QIQ.
Now, in that so-called NASA video, part one and part two, they didn't give very much explanation. Particularly in part two, he was flipping some kind of a switch, and when he flipped the switch, the RPM seemed to increase. An awful lot of missing information for me was there. Apparently, you got much more out of it.
You got to look at part three and part four. I sent both of you the videos.
Okay, yeah, Glenn, tell me what you got out of any of the parts that you saw. Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, unfortunately, Dick, I viewed all three of those videos, and I recognized what it was that they were doing because I've seen it outside of that particular video. And then basically went through it and kind of analyzed that circuit to see how it worked. I understood it just because I've seen it done before.
Yeah, Dick, you really should do something.
Thank you.
Vesely, then are you Vesely? I'm all supposed to be.
Thank you. that just called listening, W2PB. Do peanut butter.
W2PB, W2NDG, November Delta 9. This is Neil on my little 3 mile commute. Good morning.
Good morning, Neil. His name here is Paul. Sorry I didn't catch your call time. Just crossing the back and out of the driveway. Concentrating on not getting a garbage can on the way out. And I have a longer than 3 mile commute, but at least I'm not going to work. Headed off to a cardio exercise class here this morning, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. My commute is from East Islip into Babylon, so I'll probably be here for about 15 minutes, which is probably much longer than you.
Yeah, Paul, we've spoken before. Ultimately, my commute is to Manhattan, but I shortened it up by taking the train, so I only have to drive to the Huntington train station. But the call was W2NDG, my initial. Anyway, I usually don't talk much in the morning because there's really nobody on when I make this little run up to the station, but I take the later train. And the typical morning show guys are here. And that's where I've heard you, I think, when you briefly came out of retirement, I think. You can correct me on that if I'm wrong. I have the wrong person.
No, you have the right person, Neil. That was back in, I believe, November. Yeah, I came out of retirement for a week to work for the company up in Huntington. Still a great company. That's the wrong thing for me. I actually had to do that four-letter word last week. Actually, the word I used was longer than four letters. I was actually out in California for 3 days consulting. At least with consulting, if I want to work, I can't. I do. And if I don't want to work, I don't.
Well, I hear you there. I remember my father consulting a bit after he had retired years ago. And almost got shipped off to Australia for a month to consult for a little upstart dental supply company. Wanted to pick his brain, so. But ultimately, he decided that he'd rather travel around to nursing homes in California and do Abbott and Costello routines.
Okay, well, I was having an interesting conversation with my banker, I guess a couple months ago. And, she asked me, she goes, well, how many customers do you have? I go, five. Where I said, do you know why I have five? She said, no. And I said, because I don't want six. So I was actually out in California this last week consulting for my former employer. Of course, they surprised me and said, we're going to look for you to spearhead this project and take care of it. We don't have time. And I said, okay, get your checkbook ready.
I can't argue.